The Business of Biotech is produced by Life Science Connect and its community of learning, solving, and sourcing resources for biopharma decision makers. If you're working on biologics process development and manufacturing challenges, you need to swing by bioprocessonline.com. If you're trying to stay ahead of the cell or gene therapy curve, visit cellandgene.com. When it's time to map out your clinical course, let clinicalleader.com help. And if optimizing outsourcing decisions is what you're after, check out outsourcepharma.com. We're Life Science Connect, and we're here to help. The artificial intelligence and machine learning drumbeats are only getting louder in biotech, and that trend will continue for the foreseeable future. When a new tech fires up the hype machine, it's our job as industry observers to suss out what's real. Who's actually adopting and applying the technology to affect outcomes in drug discovery, development, and ultimately patient access? When virtually every biotech who's parsing a little data on a computer calls itself AI-powered, doing that sussing is easier said than done. I'm Matt Piller. This is The Business of Biotech. And on today's episode, I'm sitting down with the leader of one company that's decidedly applying sophisticated computational technologies to its biologic development efforts. Flagship pioneering's Generate Biomedicines, led by ex-Merck CMO of Human Health, Mike Nally, is using machine learning to make big use of big data. And it's raising big money along the way to support the initiative. I sat down with Mike in San Francisco to learn all about it. Let's give it a listen.
You know, we're going to talk about a lot, but I want to start with you because when I look at your background, it's not, you know, from an early point post academia, not like it wasn't written in the stars. Nope. You're going to be a biotech CEO. You were a financial analyst at Merck.
Yeah.
That came fresh off of your Harvard MBA, which came on the heels of an economics degree.
That's right.
So that was in 2003. And in 2021, you were still at Merck. You were CMO of Human Health.
Yeah.
So there's many questions in there.
Totally.
One of them being like, that's a long run. That's a long run to be at that company. So why did you decide to leave the comforts of a company like Merck, where you surely could have wrote out the entirety of your career?
Well, it's a really great question. You know, I mean, I think, you know, part of my own personal journey was, you know, when I graduated college, I grew up outside of New York City, and I thought the path of salvation was to be an investment banker because that's what all my friends' parents did.
Yeah.
I mean, my father had his own little business, and you know, in many respects, he was the anomaly within the community that I grew up within.
What was his business?
He was in sporting goods.
Oh, really?
So yeah, he's a sporting goods manufacturer. He'd go over to China, manufacture, and then sell to the mass merchants. And you know, it was a great business. But you know, he was an entrepreneur through and through. And but everyone else in the town were bankers. And you know, I went and studied finance, thinking, you know, that's what you did, you know, when you grew up. And I think, you know, as I stepped back, you know, after the first couple of years, I realized I was missing that sense of purpose. I was missing, you know, to what end am I doing all this work? And, you know, at least for me, you know, the feeling of, you know, slaving away, working, you know, 100-hour weeks to make money for rich people was not how I wanted to spend my time. And, you know, some of my best friends are investment bankers, so I don't mean any disrespect to the field. But for me personally, I wanted a broader sense of purpose in my work. And I was fortunate during that time to touch on the pharmaceutical industry. And when I went back to business school, I went with a distinct purpose of transitioning careers. Now, I was really lucky when I, you know, knew some of the folks at Merck. One of the ladies who was kind of a financial Mozart, who was Merck's CFO, the first female CFO of a Fortune 500 company, said, "Mike, if you come to Merck, I'll show you the whole company." Mm. And this is a lady named Judy Lewent. And, you know, Judy basically was true to her word. Every 18 months, I was doing a different assignment. So I started in the company as a financial analyst doing competitive intelligence, worked on the late stage pipeline, did the pre-commercialization work for a diabetes product called Januvia, was put into investor relations during the Vioxx trials, went into business development, Did the sharing cloud merger. So if you think about, you know, that sort of broad exposure, I'm a voracious learner.
I was going to say, like, you're talking about this and I'm thinking, like, you've got to be wired a little bit differently. You've got to be a sponge, right? I mean, you've got to be a sponge.
Well, I love, you know, I love science. I love, you know, kind of, you know, the learning process. Mm-hmm. There's so much complexity in the end-to-end business model for these large pharmaceutical companies. I mean, if you think about it, it's a miracle that we're able to come up with medicines.
Yeah.
And, you know, these medicines are harder than putting a man on the moon.
Sure.
You know, in the scientific challenge, the manufacturing challenges, the commercial challenges to make sure that, you know, the world has access to these medicines require really dedicated, committed professionals. And, you know, as I went on those different rotations through Merck, yeah, I was just really blessed to see the end-to-end process working with some of the best people in the industry. And, you know, within any organization, when I joined Merck, I thought I was going to be there 2 to 3 years.
Mm.
Right. And
well, now, were you thinking, like, at the time, you talked about seeking, not to get off track here, but you talked about seeking a more meaningful end, right? Rather than getting rich and making rich people richer. What was the pharmaceutical industry, life sciences? What was that sort of the, at that time, was that like, well, yeah, that's the place, or, you know, why not some other philanthropic endeavor or?
Well, I think, you know, combining a background in business with a, endeavor that basically was, you know, it's set up to improve the health and well-being of the population was something that was really attractive to me. I also loved the global nature of the industry. I loved the challenges that the industry were facing. You know, the industry's been under kind of seminal challenges for the last 25 years.
Yeah.
Right? R&D productivity going down. You think about pricing challenges, right? Access challenges. You know, these are things that unfortunately have undermined the reputation of what was once seen as a very noble industry, mm-hmm. and has made it, on par reputationally with tobacco in the lay public. And, you know, the questions we have to answer and solve for as an industry are really, really profound. And as someone who loves complex challenges, as someone who loves these sort of puzzles, trying to figure out how you right the ship so that you can solve some of the world's greatest unmet medical needs. And, you know, when you talk about sense of purpose, I've had the privilege of working on some of the most impactful programs, products that the industry's ever seen. Mm-hmm. Keytruda.
Yeah.
Right? Indicated across 30 different tumor types.
Yeah.
You think about the number of lives you can impact.
Right.
You think about Gardasil for the HPV vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the prospect that we can now eliminate cervical cancer from this planet. Some of the HIV medicines, right, where you're offering the prospect ultimately of stopping the transmission dynamics in HIV. These are things that have global impact, and, you know, millions of people are going to live longer, healthier, happier lives. Right. As a result of that work. And that's what's fulfilling what we do. Right. And that's why, you know, a year, 2 years, 3 years at Merck became 18. I was constantly learning. I was constantly challenged. I had mentors who believed in me in ways that I didn't believe in myself.
Yeah.
There were jumps that I took in my career that I probably wouldn't have taken without steady encouragement. You know, Judy was one mentor, Ken Frazier, Merck's former CEO, mm-hmm. Was another, who constantly said, Mike, we want you to go to Sweden and run our Swedish business. I had basically been to Sweden for one day in my life, knew nothing about the Swedish healthcare system, and was asked to run that organization. And, you know, those were opportunities for me to actually become much more self-aware as a professional, to learn, to grow personally with my family going to Sweden, but also professionally, but also contribute to a much greater cause. And that's part of what made, you know, the 18 years at Merck so special.
Yeah. It's interesting. The impact, you talk about the impact that you were able to play a part of in Merck. Often when I, and specific examples, Keytruda, Gardasil, I mean, amazing. Often when I talk with big bio turned biotech CEOs, they tell me that maybe ironically, the tipping point for them wanting to jump into biotech, you know, small, nimble, agile, scrappy,
right,
is because they want to feel like they have more of an impact than they did in big bio. So that's sort of an interesting dichotomy. Totally.
Well, I think you have more control in biotech.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the litmus test that I had when I thought about, you know, leaving Merck was wherever I was going to go, I had to believe fundamentally I could have a greater impact on humanity.
Mm-hmm.
And there aren't many organizations in the world that can have a greater impact on humanity than the company like Merck.
Right.
If you think about the history of the company,
yeah,
from the mass production of penicillin in the 50s, all the way through a series of antivirals, vaccines, you know, 7 of the 11 CDC recommended vaccines were invented by Merck. The cardiovascular drugs, the HIV drugs, all the way now through an array of cancer products. It's a company that's had, you know, a huge impact on society. And, you know, in the 90s, Merck was the it company.
Mm-hmm.
It was Fortune's most admired company 7 years in a row.
Yeah.
And that's because of an unparalleled track record of not only scientific innovation, but doing good for humanity. Programs like the Mectazan donation program, which, you know, have basically eliminated river blindness, were a huge part of what made the company a special place. And, you know, that is, you know, this industry at its best, where you can do good for shareholders while doing good for humanity.
Yeah.
And that was a core part of, I think, what I learned within Merck. And, you know, as I thought about going to biotech, certainly in a smaller organization, the impact of your actions and decisions, you know, at Merck, you had to influence a 72,000 person organization.
Yeah.
In a biotech organization, when I joined Generate, it was 30 people.
Yeah.
Obviously, you know, each of those 30 employees had a huge impact on the success of the organization. Sometimes it was harder to see that impact in a big company, but I think the impact of the collective work of the 72,000 was enormous.
Sure. Yeah.
And yeah, you know, depending upon how you're measuring impact, you come up with different viewpoints.
Yeah. So, I mean, if listeners didn't know that you're CEO partner at Flagship and CEO at Generate, they might think they may think you're still an executive partner. Very, very passionate about the work you did there. Why did you leave? You know, I mean, it's like you could have stayed there until
I bleed Merck teal. Like, you know, it's a company that is near and dear to my heart. It's a company with some of my best friends, some of my proudest professional moments. I was really just fortunate to uncover an amazing opportunity, what I think is a generational technology.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, when I was at Merck, one of the things that I was fortunate enough to do was lead Merck's vaccine business. While I was leading Merck's vaccine business, we had an early partnership with Moderna and vaccines.
Mm-hmm.
During that time, I got to know Stefan Bonsell and Noubar Afeyan. So Stefan is the CEO of Moderna, and Noubar is the founder and CEO of Flagship Pioneer.
Mm-hmm.
And they, you know, we had had conversations over the years around, you know, if I were ever to leave Merck, what would I want to do? And, you know, over time, I became increasingly convinced that the future of the industry was going to lie at the intersection of science and technology. And, you know, I became, you know, increasingly frustrated in many respects that the industry wasn't having enough success at changing the underlying productivity curve. Right? We've talked about it forever that in four decades in a row, industry-wide R&D productivity has been going down.
Mm-hmm.
And I think somewhat interrelatedly, but not entirely, that has led to bad pricing practices within the industry. And that those pricing practices have undermined patient access to medicines. And that's what, you know, I think creates some of the reputational conundrum that the industry finds itself within. And I became the belief on why science and technology would be this kind of potential answer. And it's simply, you know, the fact that I think it's inarguable to, you know, to look at the fact that, you know, despite staring at biology in the eye for all of our existence as humanity, we only know a small fraction,
right,
of the majesty of biology.
Yeah.
And, you know, with the advances in technology that we were seeing all around us, we were entering an age where the combination of brilliant human ingenuity and computation and technology was going to start to help us understand the language of biology in ways that the human mind alone couldn't understand it.
Mm-hmm.
And fortunately, the team at Flagship was working on a company called Generate Biomedicines. Generate was founded 5 years ago. When I first received this call, a little over three years ago, generative artificial intelligence was not part of my lexicon or the common lexicon.
Right. I mean, it's still a black box to most.
To most, yeah. And, you know, but this team recognized that by applying a top-down approach to the language of proteins and using these sort of generative technologies, we would be able to understand that language in a way that would allow us to ultimately learn how to program novel protein-based therapeutics with desired attributes.
Mm-hmm.
And in the 20 years I've been part of the industry, the early data, I had never seen anything like the early data.
Yeah.
And if you think about how we discover protein therapeutics today, we immunize a human, a mouse, a llama. We cull through plasma. We find things that stick to interesting targets. And then we manipulate them.
Mm-hmm.
In a pure trial and error process.
Yeah.
We have no control over the antibodies our immune systems create. We then try and make them into drug-like entities. Think about the world where we say, give me a molecule with this code to treat this disease.
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds science fiction. And in many ways, we're not by any means there yet.
Sure.
But we're on a path toward that destination. And this technology was helping us start to understand that language of proteins in really profound ways. And some of the things that we were able to do were just beyond my wildest imagination. You know, some of the kind of interesting tidbits that I picked up as I was looking into the opportunity were the average protein has, you know, we have 20 natural amino acids.
Mm-hmm.
The average protein may be 200 amino acids long. So if you think about the combinatorial possibilities of proteins,
yeah,
it's 20 to the 200th power. That's atoms in the universe cubed.
Yeah, yeah.
The search space is extraordinary. And oftentimes we think about nature as being this all-powerful, all-knowing, being. The reality is that nature has only surveyed a small fraction of that search space.
Mm-hmm.
It's just too large.
Right.
And if you had a technology that would allow you to survey those oceans, you're going to find some really interesting things. And we're finding that on a daily basis, these technologies are helping us understand biology better. They're helping us come up with better answers to existing conditions, but also giving us new tools now to prosecute disease in pretty unique ways.
Yeah. We're going to get back to the science of technology. Yeah. Clearly very excited about it. We're going to get back to that because I want to pause for a minute at the moment of transition. You were excited about it then.
Yeah.
And you remain excited about it. You joined Flagship.
Yeah.
You come on as CEO at Generate 2021.
That's right.
How aware were you that you were signing up for a post that was going to face the headwinds at that time? How aware were you that you were not from a scientific and excitement standpoint? Like it's, you're coming with the energy. I get it.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden you're like, yeah, I'm the CEO of this new company. We're destined to solve all these problems. And all of a sudden the whole space goes to shit.
Well, we were really lucky, right? I mean, if you think about the peak of the biotech market was February 2021.
Mm-hmm.
I started March of 2021.
Yeah. So,
but I don't think people realized that. I think people thought it was going to be a momentary blip.
Mm.
for a while in 2021. During that period, we raised, you know, $370 million as part of our Series B financing. And we raised it from an extraordinary group of investors who shared our vision for the future promise of the technology. And so, you know, as I think the downturn started to be fully realized, we were in a very strong position from a capital perspective. And, you know,
did you kind of know that, like, coming in, did you kind of know, like, this is risky? There's always inherent risk in joining a biotech and leading a biotech, but we're, you know, relative to the downward curve.
Yeah.
We're in a good position.
You know, to be honest, I think this whole idea of risk is grossly overstated, right? You know, every independent biotech endeavor has inherent risk. But if you think about the unmet need and the number of opportunities across the biotech ecosystem,
yeah,
you know, failure is part of our model. And, you know, I think as long as you're failing for, you know, valid scientific reasons, sometimes the biology just is not going to work out.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're giving it a shot, there's going to be plenty of opportunity on the other side, as long as you can, you know, manage the business side of things well.
Right.
And certainly in 2021, if you thought about the biotech ecosystem, companies were springing up left and right. So opportunity was plentiful.
Mm-hmm.
So the risk of generate not working out to me was, okay, I go do another opportunity.
Right.
And I think, you know, you've seen that across this ecosystem for a long time. We're in a glorious era of scientific innovation. And, you know, the science, you've heard this from, I'm sure, countless people, the science has never been better.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so.
So what needs to be better to sustain, because we've seen, you know, we've seen over the course of the last 18, 24, 36 months, a lot of great science get shelved.
Totally.
Back burner.
Yeah.
Flushed.
Yeah.
So you hit an important point. As long as you manage the business.
People are the rate limiter. It's not capital. Great teams are the rate limiter.
Okay.
So I think there's plentiful science, and not always will the science work out.
Mm-hmm.
You can have an extraordinary biologic hypothesis. You know, one of the things that you learn, you know, and this is part of, like, you know, if you think about my time at Merck, it's like I got a PhD in this industry from Merck. And, you know, the best scientific minds that we've ever encountered in life sciences are wrong 80-90% of the time.
Mm-hmm. Inherent in the business.
And I'm certainly not in that category, right? You know, failure is part of this model.
Yeah.
So to me, as soon as you acknowledge that, the way you manage around that to a certain extent is you build an extraordinary team, really bright people in a cross-disciplinary manner.
Mm-hmm.
If you have an opportunity, you find a portfolio or platform. And part of what attracted me to the opportunity at Flagship and the opportunity at Generate was that it wasn't a single asset.
Mm-hmm.
Because, again, I'm not smart enough to pick the winner. But if I have a portfolio,
excuse me,
I can then manage the odds in a very different way.
Right.
Across 10 assets.
Yeah.
The expected value starts to become greater than one. And in that sort of a world, I think it plays to the strengths of someone who has more of a business background.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, to me, the period of 2021, the biggest issue that we actually encountered was dilution of talent. You saw the skyrocketing number of biotech companies, of public biotech companies, of private biotech companies, of new startups. And that created position and title inflation across the industry. And the world doesn't need the sixth and seventh and eighth in class approach to the same problem.
Right.
Right. There was actually too much, you know, too many companies started. And unfortunately, I think we've had to go through a pretty rough downturn over the last couple of years And we've seen a number of those companies struggle to sustain financing through that period. But, you know, over time, you know, that raw scientific foundation is in place. You know, there still is a lot of capital and you know, certainly the assets that show real clinical proof are getting funded. And I think we'll see, you know, the pendulum, this pendulum swings back and forth on, you know, product versus platform.
Yeah.
Right. In 2021, it was in vogue to be a platform, largely because a platform technology in mRNA was saving the world.
Sure. Yeah.
In 2022 and 2023, it was much less in vogue to be a platform. Over time, that
although the RNA space still
there's still plenty of opportunities.
Still plenty of platform.
Absolutely. Yeah. But those things will go back and forth in terms of sentiment. And so, you know, I think, you know, for me, for the industry, you know, this period has been one where I think you rightly point out, you know, some really great science will get caught up in this downturn.
Mm-hmm.
Some really great teams will get caught up in this downturn. Some, you know, teams will get caught up in a valuation trap in some respects, where you're, if you raised in 2021, 2020, at the peak of the market, you know, major down rounds would be required to sustain organizations. And that's really hard. And so, you know, it's been really a rough period. But I think as we enter this year, certainly we now have had, you know, the two best months on record in the biotech industry over the last couple of months. That gives us a lot of green shoots as we enter 2024 to, you know, start to make a big difference again.
Yeah. You talked about the, you know, the fact that you probably wouldn't have signed on for such an endeavor had it been a single asset company. And that makes perfect sense. It's logical. In the platform space or the platform play, what's sort of the, like, you know, you got a single asset, you've got to hit milestones to make, you know, you got to make the money stretch to the next milestone, get more money, you know, it's kind of that leapfrog game. So I understand where the platform play gives you more to work with, but how does that change sort of the milestone picture, right? Like you've still got to produce something to reach a milestone. And
I think in terms of, you know, the executional rhythm that you want to instill within a company, I don't think it changes anything. There's just different milestones, right? I mean, I've got to be, I'm as accountable to my shareholders as a single product. So if I say I'm going to advance the technology on X, Y, and Z dimension, you know, the compact in some ways I have with my investors is, if I say I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And if I say I'm going to, you know, have two programs enter the clinic this year, I've got to show progress on that front. And so, you know, it gives you more levers. And sometimes those levers, you know, when something, you know, runs afoul, you can replace it with something else. So it gives you a bit more flexibility, a bit more optionality.
Right.
But I think the executional rigor has to be the same, irrespective of whether you're in a one product company or, you know, a platform organization.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what builds trust with your board, with other stakeholders, with your employees, for that matter.
You mentioned your 2021 Series B.
Yeah.
More recently, you raised the $280 million Series C. So I'm hoping for some insight on that, how you made that happen. What was key to it? How it was executed?
I think what was really key to it was when we look back at what we suggested we would do with our financing from our Series B, we delivered on milestones. So we had earned the trust of, you know, all of our existing investors participating in our Series C. We had 16 Series B investors.
Mm-hmm.
And all 16 of them stepped into our Series C financing. And as you can imagine, you know, given market conditions, you know, everyone was in different situations.
Right.
They all decided to continue to, you know, put the trust in, you know, the team at Generate. And that was really, really meaningful to me, to the entire organization. At the same time, we were able to attract an array of different new investors in the process. It was much, I mean, the level of diligence that went into the round was night and day between 2021 and 2023.
Yeah, that's, right? To use an overused term, let's unpack that a little bit. Yeah. That's one of the questions I had for you is, in more of a rudimentary way to put it, like what, not even necessarily frustrates you about the way the deals are being done today, but what's different about it?
Well, I think, again, I think of these things and, sometimes we hit different poles. In 21, it may have been a little loose.
Mm-hmm.
In 23, it was probably, the orientation 21 was, how do I find a way to deploy capital?
Mm-hmm.
In 23, the kind of orientation, the starting point for many investors was, I don't want to deploy capital, but I want to look.
Right.
And so you're almost finding reasons not to invest.
Right.
Versus finding reasons to invest. And, within, the round that we were able to put together, a big key of it was our ability not only to show the track record of execution, but also show the enormous promise over the next 24 to 36 months. Mm-hmm. And, as we were in the process of raising, we had talked about having, multiple programs, homegrown programs, enter the clinic. These are programs that were started by Generate a couple of years ago using the platform. The first one that went into the clinic was 17 months from concept to clinic. The second one was about 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
They're addressing major unmet medical needs, their technology, their approaches that are very distinctive, for the individual targets that we've gone after. So, in many ways, we were able to show promise to both our existing and future investors that they said, this is a great time.
Is there, this company. Yeah. Is there a difference in your mind? I mean, obviously there are a lot of variables behind the decision to invest in a company.
Yeah.
Like Generate, any company for that matter. And you mentioned the importance of the support of your existing investor base. And then you mentioned that you got some new ones. Do you see any, I guess, lines of demarcation between what turned the new ones to Generate versus those that you already had? Were the tire kickers more interested in the future? Were they happy to get on board with great investors who were happy to see results over the past 18 months?
I think, every investor follows a slightly different formula, right? So anything we say is going to be somewhat of a broad generalization. But I think the commonalities that I would pull out, right? One is, people usually back people.
Mm-hmm.
And, I've been really fortunate to be able to recruit a world-class team. And that team, I think, instills confidence in both new and existing investors. Right. And
bet on the jockey, not the horse.
And I think there's an element to that. I think to the horse.
We don't want to discredit the horse.
No, don't want to discount the horse. But generative AI is a pretty cool space for
him. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
I think, certainly, over the course of the past couple of years, it's become part of the common lexicon. And I think we started to see, on a individual and personal level, the transformative impact that these sort of technologies can have. ChatGPT raised generative AI to the collective consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
And it started to show people the enormous potential. Before the kind of generative AI revolution, most people thought of AI and ML technologies as largely efficiency plays. It was about speed and efficiency.
Right.
What generative AI has shown now is it aids the creative process. I can have ChatGPT be a thought partner.
While maintaining the speed and efficiency as well. Okay.
Or enhance.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. But the real value in our industry comes from novelty and creating the best assets. If I'm a month faster than someone and I'm inferior,
mm-hmm.
ultimately clinicians shouldn't use my. If I'm a month faster and superior, I'm going to have a whole lot of use of that product.
Yeah.
And I think what we're finding with these sort of technologies, and why I think, you know, part of, you know, you go back to your horse analogy, generative AI is a really interesting horse in applying it to biology, because the early signals and some of the early clinical programs and some of the next waves of clinical programs are suggesting that we're getting better answers than historical approaches enable. And I think that's something that if you kind of just keep pulling that thread, if you've got a capability that can give you differentiated products consistently, that's a pretty exciting proposition to get behind.
Right now, I had a conversation with a guy a bit earlier today, and I don't want to put words in his mouth, so I'm not going to name names. but he was getting to a point around, we were talking about the impact of artificial intelligence and its early impact on molecular discovery, yes. Right? And he kind of alluded to a point where he was kind of saying, like, to change the paradigm, you talked about it earlier, yes. The costs and access paradigm, there needs to be more than faster, better molecular discovery, because things get really tight and expensive, totally. And complex at the clinical level. So I guess big picture, if you look at the impact of artificial intelligence and the way that you're using it at Generate, how far along the continuum does it actually, do you envision it making an impact on better and faster, more
so? So I would, I'll challenge that underlying premise, but let me kind of just start with the end-to-end view, right? Artificial intelligence, machine learning are tools.
Mm-hmm.
They're tools to apply to all parts of our lives. And they will be applied to all parts of our lives. And all pieces of the drug discovery and development continuum will ultimately be transformed by these underlying technologies. Today, you know, we've found the sweet spot for our core company is in molecular design.
Mm-hmm.
We're starting to use it on target discovery approaches. And we're thinking about how we can use data-driven, digitally native approaches in trial execution and some of the biomarker discovery.
Mm-hmm.
But I think in the future, consistently, humans who embrace AI copilots are going to outproduce humans alone.
Yeah.
And that will be true across all parts of all industries.
That point brings up an interesting conversation that I've had many times with AI forward biotechs. And that's this concept of, especially those who maybe were born, you know, pre-AI acceptance or understanding. I've had many conversations about the nuance of successful integration of traditional biology and computational biology.
Totally.
At a physical level, at a personal level, at a, you know, intellectual property level.
That's right.
So tell me how you manage that at Generate. Like, is there a challenge there, or is it a situation where, you know, that from the company's outset, it was, we're looking for these very open-minded biologists who have some computational skill, or are you marrying two different disciplines in a, you know, throw them in a room and make them sort it out kind of way?
Well, our two co-founders who still are very active at the company, Molly Gibson and Gabor Gregorian, both are computational scientists that have studied biology, right? So Gabor was a professor at Dartmouth, but in both computer science and biology departments.
Right.
Molly was a PhD in computational systems biology from Washington University with a computer science undergrad degree. These folks have, done a brilliant job of creating an organization and a ethos as of an organization where our computational scientists are not in service of our experimentalists. Our experimentalists are not in service of our computational. We are and collaborative across the domain. And we embrace people who have that multidisciplinary training. And the single biggest predictor of success within Generate is intellectual curiosity.
Yeah.
And people who are voracious learners, who are interested in the domains, because none of us are experts in every component of this complex, you know, way maze that we call drug discovery, development, manufacturing, commercialization. Mm-hmm. We all are dependent on certain handoffs, but I think the people that can stretch across multiple parts of this, these problems are really profound that we're trying to address. Biology is extraordinarily complex. And unfortunately, we've seen, you know, while we've had, you know, a lot of organizations with extraordinary depth in individual disciplines, we've only made so much progress.
Right.
Having people that can span these different domains, I think, are going to give us a different set of answers. It's not going to solve everything.
No, but it's certainly. So, I mean, I think about it in the context of, like, you know, 3-year-old going on 4-year-old Generate had the company launched with the same mindset even 3 years earlier, much less 10 years earlier.
Right.
That talent deficit that you talked about earlier would have been even more exacerbated, right? Like in what you're doing. Are you seeing improvement in terms of, you know, replicating Molly and who else did you mention?
Sure.
Are you seeing are you seeing improvement in replicating those skill sets down the line, not just at the founder level, but down the line?
So
coming out of academia, I mean,
so there were about 100 people in the world when I started at Generate that were skilled at the intersection of machine learning and protein engineering. We knew all 100 by name.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a small niche community.
Right. Good place to be for those folks.
Right. But you know where they actually all worked? PAC.
Mm.
DeepMind, Microsoft Research, mm-hmm. Facebook, Salesforce, all had protein teams.
Yeah, that's interesting.
And, you know, obviously some were within academia as well, but, you know, it wasn't a classical path of training. And, you know, market dynamics are very powerful. Supply and demand dynamics are very powerful. Let's just say when tech enters into the bidding war for those types of talent, salaries and compensation change.
Right.
And so, you know, there has been an influx of people, you know, that are now entering these areas. To the point where we had our ML team had an internship program last year, and we had 5 spots.
Mm-hmm.
We had 2,000 applications.
Really?
Yes.
And these kids, like I say kids because I just these young aspiring professionals that are interested in a position like that, are they coming, these 2,000 people coming to the opportunity with, like, biology,
PhD, machine learning, math, biology experience?
That's what I'm wondering. Absolutely. Is it, if they're coming at it with that sort of, you know, scientific background and curiosity that you would require in an ideal world?
And listen, like some of our team, you know, may just be brilliant mathematicians that are extraordinarily versatile.
Mm-hmm.
Others will be extraordinary biologists with a natural predisposition toward computation. Right. Some are computer scientists, you know, that, you know, are very versatile. And so I don't think there's one single phenotype. But, you know, we're really fortunate to have some extraordinary people on our team. You know, both our computational team and our experimental teams are filled with brilliant people. And even our experimentalists oftentimes have computation. Because this doesn't work. You know, one of the things that, you know, has been super important from the inception of Generate was how do you view data? And unfortunately, in many organizations, data is power. It's my experiment.
Mm.
Then I have the data.
I see what you're getting at.
And, you know, when you have a machine learning approach, data has to be a collective asset.
Mm-hmm.
And you need an orientation on the experimental side that recognizes that every data point is captured to refine the computational approach. And that is not your data, it's our data. Because you know the whole machine operates on that currency. And so, you know, there's a huge cultural piece that I think is really important for these companies that are starting at this intersection. And you know, one of the debates I had for a long time with colleagues at Merck was, will it be the incumbents or the insurgents that actually crack this code? And the incumbents have huge advantages, right? Whether you're a tech incumbent or you're a pharmaceutical incumbent, you know, if you're in tech, you have some of the best computational talent. Mm-hmm. You have extraordinary resources,
right?
Right. If you're on the pharma side, you have some of the best biological talent in the world and extraordinary resources. What you know, these insurgent organizations can do, though, is create a culture that actually blends the best of both worlds. Because I think it's really, really important that, you know, in pharma, oftentimes the computational scientists are in service of the biologists.
Mm.
And in tech, if you have biologists, they're oftentimes in service of the technologists.
Right.
In these sort of organizations, the ability to create alignment and, you know, kind of a parity that, you know, these two, one, you know, it's a symbiotic relationship in many respects between, you know, the computational team and the experimental team. And, you know, that is something that I think has been, you know, really, really extraordinary to watch, to cultivate. And if you're an experimentalist and you don't subscribe to, you know, one of our five core values is around being digitally native.
Mm-hmm.
And around how data has to be a collective asset. And if you don't subscribe to that, generally it's just not the right place for you.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean you're a bad person.
When you say collective asset, I'm curious about your take on collective meaning, you know, within the four walls, so to speak, of Generate versus data being a collective asset to the industry and where the lines fall. And I'm sure it's probably both, right?
Totally.
Yeah.
I mean, you know,
but how do you, like, when you look at it from an industry-wide perspective, yeah, open source data, publicly available data, which is incredibly important,
huge.
How does that kind of shake out in terms of Generate's approach to differentiation and competition, frankly?
I mean, so when the company was started, you know, the ratio of public to proprietary data, obviously, was 1-0.
Mm-hmm.
Right? It's all public.
Yeah.
And, you know, the reason Generate was actually founded to solve the protein challenge in some respects was because there were two extraordinary public data sets. One was the sequencing revolution has given us 180 million amino acid sequences across all species. And then number two, the structural biology community gave us an extraordinary database called the Protein Data Bank, where 200,000 high quality, high resolution structures of proteins were exceptionally well curated.
Mm-hmm.
And what that allowed you to start to do is establish the interrelationship between protein sequence and protein structure. And if you think about technologies like AlphaFold from DeepMind, those in some ways were trained on these two data sets. So the ability to go from a sequence to a structure is a prediction challenge, right? And if I start to understand those two data sets, I can start to make predictions around different sequences and different, you know, structural or folding patterns.
Mm-hmm.
Generate was always oriented toward adding a third leg to the stool. As a therapeutics company, sequence and structure are interesting. Function is where the business is, right? We care about how, you know, proteins interact, how they drive biological function.
Right.
And unfortunately, there is no public database of function. And there's a number of inherent limitations in the industry to create a kind of an open source functional database. Primary among them is inherent variability of measurements. So if you were to run an assay and I were to run an assay, in different labs, we may get different values. And as we all know, with machine learning based technologies, the quality of data is paramount. Garbage in, garbage out. So part of what we've tried to do within the company is create proprietary data sets of extraordinarily well curated data. We use a lot of automation. We use miniaturization techniques, microfluidics, to do experiments at greater volumes so that we can, you know, when we run experiments, we want to collect as much data as possible. And that's allowed the company over the course of the last 5 years to go from a starting point of 100 examples to an individual experiment to the biggest experiment we've now run is 1 million defined variants. Hmm. And every one of those data points, either biophysical measurement or functional measurement, are captured and fed back to refine the computational approach. And so, you know, we've now generated, sequenced, and built into full-length proteins and tested around 5 million proteins. And all of that data now is informing our models. And that's helping us now to understand, you know, what does it mean to be a, you know, go from a protein to a drug? You know, key parameters, affinity. How tightly do I bind to the target?
Mm-hmm.
Potency, right? Immunogenicity. All of the manufacturability and developability parameters that are really important, those are things that are measured to actually help inform our modeling to say, how do I optimize to go from protein to optimal therapeutic in as quickly a time fraction as possible? And so the data sets are accumulating,
yeah,
and there are major data gaps that we still see that we're making either sizable investments ourselves or we're looking to partner.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And, you know, on the internal investment, we've made an investment in cryo-EM microscopes. So these are we have four cutting edge, world-class, high resolution cryo-EM microscopes. The reason we bought those were in that protein data bank of the 200,000 high quality, high resolution structures that I mentioned, only about 2,000 are protein-protein interactions. Most of them are freestanding proteins.
Mm-hmm.
And in medicine, or in the pursuit of medicines, you want the interaction. You want to understand what residues are driving function in that antibody-antigen interaction. And we decided that let's figure out how to supplement that data set, because that data is really valuable for our models. On the other side, there's a whole array of data that we're still very data poor as a company and as an industry. Part of why we did the partnership we have with MD Anderson, you know, MD Anderson Cancer Center, one of the world's busiest cancer centers and sees as many patients as any center in the United States, was we wanted to have understandings of the drivers of certain cancer types. We understood that at a foundational level, our technology would allow us to drug those targets. And it's been a great partnership because it brings the data from, you know, a world-renowned organization with our, you know, unique capability to create medicines for patients and hopefully get better medicines to patients faster.
I've been trying to learn about spatial biology.
Yeah.
Right? Like, this is a new trend, but right. Buzzy, is that spatial biology? Are you guys... Is that part of the play here?
Not a huge part. But I mean, listen, we combine all components of these sort of technologies. The reality for us is when we step back and we think about the opportunity that sits before us, there are these data sets that you rightly point out that are missing. Ultimately, what we're trying to do is be able to master sequence to function in a relationship.
Mm.
Because if I know the sequence to function in a relationship, what that allows me to do is program. I can sit there and type in the code to drive the desired function. And that's what if you think about like this, the real long-term massive transformation, it's taking drug discovery from the artisanal craft it is today and making biology engineer.
Yeah.
Making it programmed.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're on a path toward that.
We've spent a lot of time talking about AI, and that's good. You've given great concrete examples of the work Generate's doing. I'm curious about your take on the investor appetite for it, because there's no doubt a hype curve, right?
Yeah.
Like there's a hype curve going on right now. And you know, for the past 3 years, we've been talking about investor discernment.
Yeah.
I've got all these reasons to be discerning, you know, why, like to your point, why?
Right.
I don't want to invest in AI. Should I? AI is one of those things that I feel like there are so many companies that are riding that hype curve right now. That's an area where investors should be discerning. Yeah. Like if you come at you know, a conference like this and you say, wow, you know, machine learning and AI, let's pull back the covers and have a closer look, right? Yeah. So give me some, I guess, color around how, like if you're speaking to the investment community, which you are,
yeah.
You get a lot of VCs listening to this podcast, how they should be discerning hype from reality around artificial intelligence forward biotechs right now.
I mean, I always start with the people, right? I mean, I carefully scrutinize the team of the organization that we would potentially work with, partner with.
Mm-hmm. The people, not the app. Like, don't look at, well, you know, we've got an app or we've got we're outsourcing to a
look at the individuals that are actually driving that technology. And are these folks, you know, among, you know, the world class contingent in those domains? I look at the publications that they've done either while they're within their organizations or in prior lives, to understand the quality of their science. You know, we recently published one of our models. It's a model called Chroma, and it was in Nature. Right. So when people ask me, like, you know, how do I know the quality of your machine learning? You can see the Nature publication.
Right.
You know, have a read at it. Right. And you'll see, you know, we're really blessed with an extraordinary team of machine learning scientists. I think then, you know, you obviously have to look at the technology as well. Because, you know, it's great to have great people, but if they're not translating that into a technology that's really meaningful, and then, you know, the technology though, or the concept, I think, you know, we can all use the same words. The question then becomes the translatability. And, you know, what I ultimately want to be judged by is the output.
Mm-hmm.
Are we creating better drugs than we could have otherwise?
Yeah.
And, you know, there are going to be a series of interim markers until we hit the real marker. Do these drugs make a difference in patients' lives? And that is, you know, the definition of success that I aspire to, that Generate aspires to. Because of the nascency of some of these technologies, we're just early in that journey. And I think, unfortunately, sometimes the long lead times in pharmaceutical discovery and development obscure progress or the view of progress, right? The revolution is happening right now.
Yeah.
The outcome of that revolution, given the regulatory paradigm that we have in front of us, is maybe a decade away.
That long lead time you anticipate that lead time will remain in the interim.
I don't think we collapse clinical trials under the current FDA guidance in the very short term.
So we're getting to clinical trials quicker.
I mean, you're taking, you know, a 10 to 15 year process cutting off a couple of years. Ideally and theoretically, you should be getting to better answers, which changes probabilities. But again, we're going to have to wait time to judge that.
Right.
I think, you know, will there be opportunities for further compression? Absolutely. Will we find ways of compressing the clinical trial dynamics? I believe so. I believe both there'll be better preclinical models and ways of enriching clinical trials to do that better. But, you know, the nature of our business right now, you know, is, you know, that is the path that we have to take. And these technologies should be held to the same level of scrutiny as, you know, a technology that was discovered through more traditional means.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'll look in your crystal ball, right?
Yeah.
Questions, everyone hates that to answer. How long before you and I are sitting here having a conversation about the impact of these technologies on clinical trials? Because that is at the inflection point that we're at right now in terms of its impact on molecular discovery and design.
I think we're going to start to see impact over the next few years.
Yeah.
I think we'll look back in the very near future and these technologies will be pervasive in everything we do.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, you know, we're just learning how to interact with the ChatGPTs of the world.
Do you have any concerns?
Of course. I mean, these are extraordinarily powerful tools. But we already have some pretty extraordinarily powerful tools. These just seem
to be trusted with, right?
That's right. And so, you know, I mean, like all of these things have to be pursued with due caution and due consideration. But, you know, the reality is I think the good outweighs the concerns in a pretty massive way. You know, for us, you know, it's interesting. You know, one of the things that people all say to me all the time is like, well, Mike, how do you deal with the hallucinations of generative AI?
Mm-hmm.
Well, in a construct where you have this tight integration of dry and wet lab, we experimentally validate everything. So the hallucinations actually are enormously powerful for our modeling.
Because it's iterative. It helps.
Yeah, because we learn.
Right.
We learn from failure in a way that the industry's never learned from failure.
Mm-hmm.
And if the model is ultimately hallucinating, that protein doesn't express and it doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
And that data's already fed back.
Right.
And so it helps us get to a better answer faster.
Yeah.
And, you know, those sort of bugs are actually features in many respects in this sort of world where you're experimentally validating. I think if you're just thinking that computation is going to solve everything, you know, I greatly discount organizations in biology that think computation will solve everything. Our workforce is skewed. You know, everyone considers us an AI ML drug discovery company.
Mm-hmm.
Our workforce is skewed toward experimentalists. We have about 2/3 of our workforce that are experimentalists.
Yeah.
And that's just because we have to validate. We have to measure. We have to generate the data. And the only way to do that is through experimentation, to do it reliably. And so, you know, for us, certainly in the short, medium, and I'd say, you know, medium to long term, you know, the paucity of data, functional data, the data that we really care about across a number of domains in life sciences will lead us to a place where, you know, we are constantly needing more and more information to refine these computational approaches to get to the best answers as fast as possible.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And I'm curious about where you are, if you want to share some information on where you are right now and what the next step might be for Generate.
Yeah. Well, I mean, excitingly, our first two molecules entered the clinic in 2023.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that is a major milestone for any company. And, you know, we're extraordinarily proud that, you know, we're now starting to see the benefits, you know, in people. And, you know, those programs we think could, you know, address major areas of unmet medical need. Behind it, though, we have roughly 20 programs. A number of those are in partnership. So we have 6 in partnership with Amgen. I mentioned the MD Anderson partnership where we're now working on 3 different targets. We're working with Roswell Park Cancer Center on a number of other targets. Mm-hmm. And then we have an internal pipeline for Generate of, you know, around 8 to 10 programs that we're working on from a proprietary standpoint. And so, you know, we're in this transitional state of an organization where, you know, for the first few years, we were really a pure technology company.
Mm-hmm.
We were developing a technology Now we're kind of morphing into a technology company that discovers drugs and that develops drugs. And so, you know, you're seeing a bit of a transformation within the organization to bring in some of the skills and capabilities. And I think, you know, from a business, you know, building the organization, that creates some interesting cultural dynamics, which we're working through. But, you know, clearly we need, you know, the experience of seasoned drug hunters and drug developers with the pioneering spirit of the original technology developers. And so it's something that we spend a lot of time, you know, thinking through. And then, you know, from a technology perspective, we're scratching the surface of application. I always say to the team, like, the one thing I know definitively is I don't know the best use of the technology at this point. I know there are multiple multi-billion-dollar applications for the technology, but where this will have the greatest impact on humanity, we're still searching. And that leads to a bit of a dynamic where you're constantly balancing kind of exploration and exploitation, right? So when you find those areas where we can make impact, how do we do more of those versus expanding the aperture? The technology is protein modality agnostic. So it works across antibodies, peptides, enzymes, cell, gene therapy, all our protein boundaries, ADCs, bispecifics.
That's a good place to be.
Yeah. Right?
Right.
Yeah. So you have a ton of real estate to cover. Which of those domains will we have greatest advantage over traditional approaches? We're still learning. My guess is it's going to be a more complex biology. If you think about where computers routinely outperform humans, it's in complex multi-parameter optimization. And the more complex the biological construct in many respects, I think the computer ultimately will show inherent advantage.
Sure.
So those sort of challenges as we go forward are super interesting. And you're trying to do that while you're trying to execute on these clinical programs, bring the next generation of programs to the fore, and developing a technology that I believe will ultimately change the way the whole industry creates large molecules. And I don't say that, you know, lightly. We can debate how long that may be. But I think it's inevitable that, you know, over time, you know, these sort of approaches will provide a foundationally better way of coming up with the right answer than the traditional artisanal approach.
I know we're running short on time here, so I could ask you questions well into the evening. But I'm curious about you. One of the things you mentioned is sort of the cultural change of generated into a drug development company, not away from a tech, but being built on a technology company. And I'm curious about how, like, you know, if you're doing that, if you're leading a company that's doing that on an island, you know, sort of unto itself, the challenge, it occurs to me, might be more daunting than it would be for flagship pioneering partner CEO.
Yeah.
How much support, like how advantageous is it for you? I'm not insinuating that perhaps you're sniping drug development talent from other flagship companies, but how advantageous is it for you to kind of be part of that ecosystem?
I mean, listen, it's a special ecosystem, right? What flagship's been able to build it is really extraordinary. And it's not for the faint of heart, right? You know, most innovation occurs in an incremental fashion. Most innovation from most organizations is around the edges. Flagship lives in the white spaces. And, you know, even the name of the organization, you know, is highly symbolic, right? Flagship pioneering.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of the time we spend thinking about is, what does it mean to be a pioneer? What does it mean to push on into new areas, frontiers? How do you orient? And how do you make it inhabitable for other settlers? How do you keep pushing boundaries?
Right. The immigrant mentality. I hear it every time I talk with a flagship.
Absolutely. And you know, I think one of the other things that we spend a lot of time thinking about are kind of dualities of leadership. Oftentimes, you know, we think about, you know, the world in black and white terms. Mm-hmm. And everyone says, well, no, let's live in the gray zone. You know, oftentimes what we believe is that, you know, you need polar experience. You need to be able to balance between the two poles, not in between.
Right.
And it's those sort of mindsets that I think become super valuable in these sort of, domains. You know, you probably have heard Neubauer talk about paranoid optimism, mm-hmm. right? That's one of those dualities. Sometimes we need to be paranoid. Oftentimes we need to be optimistic.
Right.
And how do you, rather than kind of sitting there in between, how do we embrace both of the poles as we develop these sort of organizations? And so certainly it's really nice when you're doing things that people haven't done before and you have guides that have been on similar journeys.
Right.
That can help you understand from their own experiences.
Yeah.
And, you know, the team at Flagship, as I mentioned, Stefan, who is a member of the board, who's created, obviously, Moderna, they've been huge, teachers for me, for the team at Generate, sharing their experiences in a very open, transparent way. And most importantly, not just the successes, but the failures. Because mm-hmm. we oftentimes talk a lot about what went well, but you sometimes learn the most from the mistakes that organizations make on these sort of journeys.
Sure. And we stated at the outset, it's a failure is inherent. And if you're not taking anything away from that, then
that's right.
It's on you.
You're losing.
Yeah.
And, the team at Flagship, Neubauer, Jeff, Avak, that were kind of the founding team of Generate, have been, extraordinary mentors, ambassadors, teachers, guides, as we've gone on this journey. And for someone that is coming from, a big company, mm-hmm. doing this for the first time, being able to surround myself with those sort of people and a whole cohort of other CEO partners that are also doing this journey for the first time with an array of different backgrounds. That's an enormous asset because, as you talk to a lot of folks in these sort of roles, mm-hmm. these roles can be really lonely. Mm-hmm. And having that sort of ecosystem to pull upon is of huge, huge value. And it gives you a sense of calm in massive places of uncertainty. And, I'm enormously grateful for that.
Well, I'm enormously grateful for you taking time out of this busy week to spend with me on the Business of Biotech. So I really appreciate it.
I'm Matt Piller, and you just listened to the Business of Biotech, the weekly podcast dedicated to the builders of biotech. We drop a new episode with a new exec every Monday morning. And I'd like you to join our community of subscribers at bioprocessonline.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, or anywhere you get your podcasts. You can also subscribe to our never spammy, always insightful monthly newsletter at bioprocessonline.com/BOB. If you have feedback or topic and guest suggestions, hit me up on LinkedIn and let's chat. And as always, thanks for listening.